The Lord be with you. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Matthew. Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, conversing with him. Then Peter said to Jesus in reply, "Lord, it is good that we are here. If you wish, I will make three tents here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud cast a shadow over them, and from the cloud came a voice that said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell prostrate and were very much afraid. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Rise and do not be afraid." And when the disciples raised their eyes, they saw no one else but Jesus alone. As they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, "Do not tell the vision to anyone until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." The Gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ. The Transfiguration, if you were to become, in ancient days, an icon painter, and they say writer, icon writer is the way they speak a little bit different. If you were painting icons and you were trained in that, your very first piece that you would do would be the Transfiguration. Not other scenes. You didn't just like pick whatever. No, and it was very intentional to spend time contemplating. Because as you're painting a scene like this, I don't know if any of you are painters, but if you can just imagine, if you're going to paint a scene, you really have to immerse yourself into it, and have contemplated and prayed about it and imagined it and visualized it, not just how it was going to be on the canvas. On the wood that they would paint an icon on, but also just how did it really come across, so I can somehow capture that, synthesize that, communicate that into and have that come across in the icon itself. We want to do the same thing with this scene. We want to spend time with it. We don't want to rush through it or just hear it and then keep in our mind some kind of a, almost like a factoid, like, "Oh yeah, Jesus," like the answer to a Jeopardy question. Where did you, "Oh yeah, it was on Mount Tabor," and we know the data, but it doesn't really affect us. It's just like a Trivial Pursuit question or something. And we don't want to have it as some kind of a caricature of some kind of, I don't know, maybe in your own brain when you try to, if you don't have a real well-developed imagination, you try to imagine the scene and it comes across something like a children's illustration where everything's like super simplified and stripped down to a cartoon version of it or something like that. But when we meditate on a scene for the gospel, what we want to do is place ourselves physically there. Maybe beginning on this journey, they went up to the mountain. They won the other gospel. This scene is repeated in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And then each of the gospels has a little bit of a different details that it highlights. And Jesus takes them up, these three, up the mountain to pray. And if you go to Jerusalem, to the Holy Land today, you can go up this mountain, Mount Tabor. It's up in the northern part of Israel, close to the Sea of Galilee, close to Nazareth. And it's really steep. I mean, if you go now, you can either They used to have camels that would take you up, and there's switchbacks to get up. It's really that super steep. But it flattens out on the top, and up there there's a large area, and there's a church built there, as you might imagine, called the Church of Transfiguration. There was a real original thought there. But if we imagine ourselves going up there, climbing up with no path, so scrambling up through the trees and the shrubs that on our way up there, it's hard work, and we're getting scratched up and we're getting dirty, but we're leaving stuff behind. The rest of the disciples, the crowds that wanted to see Jesus because they had brought someone on a stretcher to be healed, that they're clamoring for preaching, for attention, just for Christ to come by and maybe lay his hand on them, and they're pulling aside and climbing up the mountain to pray. And the higher you get, if anyone's done mountain climbing, the higher you get, the more it seems so much more distant down below. And it's almost like, even though it might be chaotic and busy down below, the higher you get, the more peaceful it seems. Like if you go up the Empire State Building, you go out on there, it's like you look down, or any of the tall buildings, you look down, it just seems like, wow, it just seems so beautiful in a certain way. Now, we know what's going on down on the streets. It's not beautiful down there necessarily. But when we distance ourselves back away, as we go higher and higher, it's almost like we're seeing the world the way God sees it. He's very much in the detail, very much down there. But he also is seeing it from this epic viewpoint. And I think that's part of the reason why it's built into our spiritual DNA that God is up the mountain. God is high. We have to go up high in order to be closer to God. There is no religion that has heaven down there and hell up there. It's the way we're wired. It's the way we're created. I don't know. Maybe someone can pull up. Oh, yeah, there's that one over. Okay. Maybe that's so. But so now when we're up on the top of the mountain there with the apostles, they're tired. They're sleepy. Then one of the other gospels, it says how their eyes were heavy with sleep. They're just barely, because they're praying now. And they've gotten up there. They're tired. Maybe they're a bit hungry. And they're kind of like doing that head bob thing that you do when you're trying to stay awake, but you really can't. And they're just about asleep, but all of a sudden they have this sense that something is tremendously different right there. And they snap awake, fully awake. And there Jesus is there before them, his face shining like the sun in its full strength. That's the way John would talk about it later in the book of Revelation. He was there. He saw it. And so in the book of Revelation, he's building it. No, I know what God is like. I saw it with my own eyes. And so everything that you see in the book of Revelation, all these mysterious, grandiose, mythical, epic scenes, he already had a taste of it. He saw Christ. I mean, imagine that. What would it be like for someone's face to be so brilliant? It's like looking at the sun, yet you can still look at it. Because normally you look at the sun and it burns your eyes out. And you can't see anymore. But here they're able to look directly and not be blinded. His clothing became brilliantly white. When Moses and Elijah appear next to him in glory, and they're conversing. One of the other tellings of it, I believe it's in Luke, speaks about how they were conversing about Christ's upcoming passion. What's going to happen? He's going to be crucified. This one, the one with the glorious, resplendent face, is going to be crucified. Is going to suffer and be crucified. Who could even pull that off? Moses and Elijah were there. They both have their own stories. Moses, after having brought the people out of Israel, out of Egypt, through the Red Sea, and they're in the desert, and he is at wit's end, And it's been a very hard journey for him. God invites him, where? Up the mountain. And Moses asks, Lord, I want to see your glory. And God tells him, you can't see my glory. Because if you do, you'll die. If you look at the sun, your eyes will be burned out. And so God passes by and said, and as he's passing by, he puts Moses in this sort of cleft in the rock, as it says. And as he passes by, he puts his hand over Jesus, or excuse me, over Moses, so that he can't see until he's passed by. And then he removes his hand, so Moses can only see God from behind. So he doesn't get to see his face. Elijah had a similar experience. Elijah had been persecuted. Jezebel was trying to kill him, and he flees for his life, and he ends up on the same mountain that Moses was up on. And he goes up there, and he's at wit's end. He doesn't know what to do, and God asks him as he's up on the mountain, Elijah, why are you here? I mean, God knows why he's there. And Elijah just says, I'm the only one left that gives you that the only prophet left in this land, and they're trying to, even with this, they're trying to kill me, and I'm trying to serve you and give you, and like, God knows that he how much Elijah desires to be close to God and give witness to God and be faithful to God, and yet everything around him is militating against that. Nobody wants his message. Nobody wants to listen to him. He had also slaughtered 200 prophets at the Baal, so he was kind of in trouble for that too. And God says, okay, I'm going to pass by. And he also doesn't get to see God's face. There's the storm, and then there's the earthquake, and then there's boulders crashing, and then there's a firestorm that takes place. And then all of a sudden, it's only in the still whisper that he hears, he knows that now's the time. So he takes his mantle, covers his face to go out to be before God, because he knows he can't look on God. And it's in the sound of sheer silence that God is present to him, and he knows that God is present. They wanted to see God. They desired to see God. They journeyed to see God. They climbed up the mountain to see God, and they didn't see him. Not directly. There was still a veil that separated them. It wasn't time. They knew he was near. They knew he was in it. There's all these manifestations of God's presence, him working in their own lives and in so many different ways, yet they couldn't quite look on his face. God was waiting for his son so that his son would be the face of God to Moses, to Elijah, to John, Peter, James. You can imagine for Peter and James, place yourself back there again for a moment. What's the expression on their face? What's racing through their heart and their mind as they're seeing someone that they've been living with now for a year and a half or so transfigured like this? They are going to remember that for the rest of their life. It is going to impact the way they would talk about Christ, the way that Peter puts it in his letter. In that time we were up on the mountain and he was transfigured. And John works it into the book of Revelation. And you can imagine, like, let's say if you were talking to someone, there's this gentleman and he's the Messiah, and I went up this mountain, I saw his face was transfigured, it turned white. You would think that this guy is off his meds or something like that, or on some kind of a trip. But then Peter and James, in their preaching, there's just so much truth coming out. There's so much beauty in what they're doing, what they're saying, and they're also, you brought your ill friend there, and they were just cured by Peter reaching out his hand and touching him. And it's like, okay, well, I don't know about that story, but I know that. So if this is true, this miracle is so, this is also true as well. It's just baked into their testimony. They put a, and the, having seen this, puts a fire in their own belly in order to explain who this was. This wasn't just a man. We saw him, and I've never seen a man like that before. Not transfigured like that. It's good for us to foster in our own heart a desire to see Christ glorified like that, transfigured. And what would the circumstance be? Where would you go to have an experience like that? Peter and James, they just stuck with Jesus, and it happened. Moses and Elijah climbed a mountain, and it didn't quite happen. It got really close. It wouldn't only be until later when Jesus would come along they would see it. What kind of distance do we have to create from the chaos and the busyness of our ordinary work for something like this to happen? If we're just puttering away at our normal job or something like this, we wouldn't expect God just to burst onto the scene in this kind of brilliance. We know he's there. We know he's with us. We see his fingerprints in different moments in our life. Sometimes maybe it's a matter we first have to go through great difficulty and trial, as Moses did, Elijah did. Maybe we have to climb a mountain where there really isn't a trail there, and the brambles are scraping us up, and we didn't bring enough food for the journey, and we're going up there, and we're trying to pray, and our eyes are just getting heavy with sleep, and we're just barely, and then Christ bursts through. We don't know what God's timing is going to be for us. What we do know is that we have to be open. We have to be willing to climb the mountain. In a very real way, that's what Lent is meant to be, this amount of stripping away the things that being able to step away, at least in some shape or form, from the things that distract us from prayer, things that clutter our mind and our heart and our psyche, in order to be able to get up on that mountain, at least in part. If we're scrolling for 15 hours about the latest updates on the situation in Iran, you're probably not going to have one of these moments with Christ. Probably. Guys, I'm talking to you. Guys seem to do that even worse. I don't know. I do it. I started doing it. I said, stop doing that. I mean, I'm going to do an Exodus 90. I'm not supposed to be on social media. And so I put it down. So we're all going to have high moments and low moments, mountaintop moments, and moments when we're anywhere except on top of a mountain. But when we do get these glimpses, maybe it's just seeing Christ from behind. Maybe it's just a little bit of a sense that God is near, maybe what Elijah had or what Moses had, or even a powerful experience. Lean into those. Those moments are going to sustain you in the moments that you're down in the valley. You're going to be reminded when you walk up to the foot of the cross that, but I have seen his face glorified, and I'm not going anywhere. And it's going to give you faith and confidence and hope when everything comes together for the resurrection as well. Ah, now I understand, as we look backwards. So we ask for this gift of seeing the Lord face to face. It says in the St. Paul speaks about it, when we see him face to face, we'll be transformed to become like him, for we will see him as he is. That's the promise of heaven. It's the promise that Christ gives to each one of us, if we'll lay down at least for a while our troubles and our distractions and climb up the mountain.